So what happened here? Well, the study continued for a few months. Initially assessed Elmer when he was about 8.5 months old, and I think it wraps up when he's about 14 months of age. Watson always intended to reverse the conditioned emotional response. He was going to extinguish it. And he wanted to do it not because it was nice to do, you know, he didn't want Albert to have this fear for long term, but he wanted to do it to prove his point that he could create and eliminate emotional responses strictly through conditioning, through conditioning processes. Unfortunately for Watson's study, his mother, or Albert's mother, her job as a wet nurse was completed, and she left the hospital at that point, and so he was never able to finish this. I mean, Watson wasn't, you know, pushing real hard on this, right? I mean, this study goes on over a period of months. And really, there's not that many days of conditioning and testing. Okay, so I mean, nowadays, by today's standards, you'd want to run this study over, you know, a couple of weeks tops and get it done with. But it just sort of, you know, as it happened, you know. Watson had other things going on. He was the president of the APA, American Psych Association. He was the editor of a publication. He had other research going. He was having to, you know, filming this stuff was actually difficult. He had to go ask the university president to scare up funds for him to, you know, spend something like $500 to get the film to film this. In today's standards, that's like maybe $12,000 or $14,000 worth of film to film this. Over the time. And so, you know, there's probably a lot going on. But still, you know, it didn't happen quickly. He probably could have pushed harder and gotten this all wrapped up and done and whatnot, but he didn't. Regardless, he did demonstrate that he could produce a conditioned emotional response. Now, this research led directly to Mary Cover Jones's counter-conditioning work with Peter a few years later. So Peter's got a phobia of rabbits, and Mary Cover Jones, first woman in the U.S. to get a Ph.D., incidentally, cool lady. And she knew Watson, so she knew of Watson's conditioned emotional response work with Albert and knew Watson directly. But she then took and sort of gave it a little twist and used it for a therapeutic approach to eliminate Peter's fear of rabbits. Now, whatever happened to Albert, through the 20th century, this has been one of those big sort of questions about what happened to Albert. And there had been at least three attempts to try to track Albert down, and they all failed through the 20th century. No success. Into the 21st century, Beck, Levinson, and Irons, just last year, 2009, published a little article on this. About 7 years of sort of historic and genealogical work and looking for records and through census data and whatnot. And making some assumptions and doing a variety of sort of data archival work, they came to the conclusion that Albert B.'s mother was probably a woman named Arvilla Irons Moret. Now, they don't have... she had a son at Johns Hopkins Hospital on the 9th of March, 1919. Given that Albert was about 8.5 months old when the study started, they suspect, Beck and colleagues suspect that this was actually Albert's mother. Interestingly, the third author here is Arvilla's grandson on this one, so they track down the family. So Douglas Moret would have been born 9th of March, 1919. And they think this was actually who Albert was. The issue with the Irons, they think he's probably illegitimate. The Moret may have been a made-up name to avoid censure for having an illegitimate child. There's no evidence that there was a Mr. Moret anywhere in the picture on this. Anyways, she did work as a wet nurse. She left Johns Hopkins then in 1920 and went to work as essentially a hospice care assisting the a very ill wife of a farmer out of state. The farmer's wife died, it seems, from meningitis. Now, tracking this all down, I'm not going to give you the long, sort of interesting historical account of doing all this, but it turns out that Douglas Merritt died on the 10th of May, 1925, which was shortly after this farmer's wife would have died, and from the death certificates and reports, it seems likely that he died of meningitis. So he probably contracted the meningitis from the woman his mother was looking after. So that's probably what happened to Albert. So, you know, kind of tragic in some ways there. You know, there's ruins in some way as well. Some, you know, a lot of textbooks that suggest, and just think, you know, a man of 80 years of age walks into a psychologist's office and says he's afraid of rabbits and furry things and rats and whatnot. But anyways, so some people are you know, quibbling with Beck, Levinson, and Iron's interpretation that this was, in fact, Albert. But we'll probably never know for sure. But like I said, no one had been able through the 20th century, starting in like the late 40s, I think, much earlier, no one's ever been able to find alive Albert, even, you know, only 20 years later. So this is probably what happened. Why would Watson have called the child Albert B? There was another woman working at the hospital with the last name of, I can't remember what the B, what her name was. And so the possibility is maybe this was a different child, was Albert, this other woman's son. The authors, Beck, has some reasons for suggesting not here. And they also point out that Watson seemed to like to play name games. Watson's mother and grandmother were extremely religious, very Baptist. And so he, in fact, was named after a Baptist minister, John Albert Brodus. That's how we get his rather odd John Brodus Watson out of this. Watson named his sons, with Rosalie Rayner, William and James. William James, psychologist. Okay. Now, Watson didn't agree with everything that James said and wrote, but in his writings, he was very much respected James as a researcher. So, you know, again, we don't know for sure. We don't know if this is the case or not. But, you know, the suggestion here is maybe he took the Albert B from Albert Brodus. So John Brodus, Albert Brodus, Albert B. Possibility there. There wasn't really a concern with ethical concern with confidentiality of names at this time in the early 20th century. This hadn't really come into ethics yet, so we don't know exactly. But odds are, it seems the Beck and colleagues present a fairly compelling argument that Albert died at age six there. Whatever happened to Watson, though? While conducting this research, little Albert study, Watson begins an affair with his graduate student, Rosalie Rayner, which is problematic because he's married to somebody else. His wife, he writes Rosalie Rayner various love letters and whatnot. His wife is suspicious, and at a party at the Rayner family home, she fakes an illness and says she needs to go lay down, and sneaks into Rayner's room, ransacks her desk, and finds the love letters from her husband to his graduate student, and this all comes out in court. It's an extremely messy divorce. Today's standards, you know, hey, I'm not saying it's a good idea for professors to be having affairs with their students, but I mean, it's not really going to get a professor fired. 1921, this is a massive scandal, just huge. And Watson is asked to resign his position at Johns Hopkins. He refuses, and so he essentially gets fired. This then necessitates that he resign as the president of the APA, and no other university will touch him at this point. So he cannot get another academic position. He ends up going into advertising. He works for the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency. He started out essentially as just a salesman, and within 2 years made vice president. Now, he worked on some things like Pond's Cold Cream. Not sure what a Pond's Cold Cream is. Better not to think about that. So he worked on things like a Pond's Cold Cream campaign. The Maxwell House Coffee, some of the early Maxwell House Coffee advertisements. Some people credit him with inventing the concept of coffee break. You know, take a break for coffee as opposed to just drink your coffee with breakfast or whatnot. Although there's no, you know, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Who knows there. Besides working in advertising and making a sod of a lot of money, way more money than he was making as an academic, so did okay here. He published books and articles on child care. So in 1928, he published Psychological Care of Infant and Child. Now, many subsequent or more modern child experts or child rearing advocates were extremely critical of Watson's view on child rearing. Watson recommended not being too emotionally effusive towards children. His concern was that if you were overly emotional to the children, then they're going to have a harsh reality when they hit the real world, and the rest of the world, people out there, are not as friendly and happy and loving towards them. I mean, it's also part, you know, depression is, you know, coming on here. So it's been criticized by subsequent writers, but frankly, looking at this, his views towards child care were really not any more extreme than most of the other child care type books that were out there at the time. And in fact, contrary to many of the other books that were out there, I feel like I'm a John Watson defender. That's not really it. It's just, you know, let's have the facts here right. He was actually strongly opposed to using spanking or corporal punishment from the psychological perspective. He thought this was highly problematic. Whereas most advocates at the time were saying, oh yeah, go ahead, beat the kid. You know, no, teach him respect. Build a character. That sort of thing. So, you know, Watson's become somewhat vilified over the years for this, but perhaps not with any particular good reason. Okay. Now, there are other, I mean, you know, that's sort of what started a lot of this, but nowadays we don't tend to do this many studies directly with people. We certainly don't do these kinds of conditioned emotional response studies with children. We tend to use non-humans. And nowadays, we don't tend to throw rats or monkeys or things at people or at other animals. We typically use the shock as the thing that's going to induce the fear. Now, we do work with rats, though. So the rats that started in the little Albert stuff do, in fact, come back into our modern non-human studies of fear. Rats are great for this. Rats have a very pronounced response to fear-eliciting stimuli. It's a species-specific defense reaction, at least one of them. They freeze. They just freeze in place. So you can use what's called a condition suppression ratio for this. With rats, you train them to make an operant response. So press a lever to get food, train a CS plus for an aversive US, put the rat back into its operant chamber, let it be pressing away on the lever, and periodically give the CS plus here, and see whether or not it freezes. If it freezes, it's not pressing the lever. So this becomes your measure of the conditional response, the fear response. How much is the lever pressing suppressed? So here's a little video of this. It goes on for a little while. So the rat's over there on the side, pressing away at the lever there to get food, sticks its head into the little... Oh, it just got a shock. Okay. Foot shock there. This goes on and on and on. So tone. So I think what they're showing right now is just a random non-contingent tone. Oh, no, okay, they've started doing... Right. Initially, it was non-contingent. Now they've shifted to doing shock paired with a tone. So they do 10 shock tones, And now, see what happened there. Now, they're just giving it a test trial of the tone. They're not going to shock the rat at this point. But notice, it moved away from the lever, and okay, that's going to be a suppression. That's the suppression there. Oh, and then it gets a shock. Okay, afterwards. So, it's a little bit of an odd way to sort of sequence that there, but you get the idea. You get the idea. I hope with that one. I think I'm gonna have to sneak into people's rat labs on campus and start filming, you know, to get better videos of what I want for teaching. Okay. Now the suppression ratio, very handy, very useful. Actually, very straightforward, but sometimes a little bit confusing to people because it seems to work in a reverse way. So what we do is suppression ratio is going to be equal to the amount of responding during the presentation of the CS divided by the amount of responding during the presentation of the CS and the amount of the responding that was made before the CS was presented. So if your CS is presented for 20 seconds, then you'd also measure the number of responses, the amount of responding made in the 20 seconds prior to presenting the CS. Okay, so that becomes your numerator and denominator. Now, if you end up with a suppression ratio of zero, your behavior has been entirely suppressed here. If you get 0.5, then there's no suppression. It can run from zero to 0.5. So an example here, let's say that our pre-CS responding is 25. So before the CS is presented, during testing, makes 25 responses. During the CS presentation, it makes 25 responses. So 25 divided by 25 plus 25, 25 divided by 50, 0.5. Okay? There has been no learning about the CS at all here. Right? There is no suppression. Made 25 after or 25 before the CS is presented, 25 during the CS. Contrast this with makes 25 responses before the CS and now zero. In other words, it's frozen. Okay, zero divided by zero plus 25, zero divided by 25, zero. Okay. Something intermediate makes 25 responses before, makes 15 responses now during the presentation of the CS, 15 divided by 40.375. So there's been some suppression in this third case here. Okay, so that's the suppression ratio. I'm doing the timelines. Okay. Sign tracking. Sign tracking goes back a while. Now the term auto shaping is used sort of synonymously with sign tracking. I'm a little mixed on that one myself, but most of the literature is doing this now. Auto shaping is a term coined by Brown and Jenkins in 1968. They were working with pigeons, and they trained the pigeons to use things like grinders and stuff to actually fix dents in cars. So they were reshaping the bodywork. I'm mixed as to whether or not this is actually some... Anybody? Nobody? Most people are just like, body work. No, of course not. Can you imagine a pigeon with a grinder? No? Okay. No. Auto shaping. What they did in 1968 was they would present a stimulus at a random time, so variable time, and the stimulus would be on for 8 seconds, and at the end of the 8 seconds, food would blink, drop into a little food dispenser. And the stimulus was a little light. It was a little key light that would come on. And the pigeons wouldn't have to do anything to get the food. They just have to go down, eat the food, stick their head into the food dispenser, eat the food. Okay? But the food's only going to be there for a few seconds. Then a little trap door opens and it's gone. So the light comes on and says, hey, if you're someplace else in the operant chamber, you should hustle over there, stick your head into the dispenser and get the food. What they find, and no response is required. This is not an operant contingency at all. All they have to do is go eat the food. What Brown Jenkins found was that typically after 100, 150 presentations like this with the light indicating that food was about to be delivered, the pigeons would go over and just start pecking away at the light. And they'd peck at the light so much that they wouldn't bother eating the food. They've missed the food. So that's the auto shaping. In other words, if you will, they were automatically shaped to press the little key light. Okay. Sign tracking originally was designed such that you've got a subject in a cage, usually fairly long a cage. There's going to be food at one end of the cage, a stimulus somewhere else in the cage. And again, similar thing. The stimulus indicates when the food is going to be delivered. And what tends to happen in the sign tracking is, yeah, the subject figures this out and starts going over to get the food and whatnot, but it starts paying more and more and more attention to the stimulus, the CS, that indicates that the food is coming until eventually it actually heads over to the CS and starts directing food-related behavior towards the CS itself, like nibbling or licking at the a light that indicates food. So that would be sign tracking there. So they're very similar. Auto shaping, sign tracking, very, very similar there. So what seems to be happening is the CS takes on the properties of the US. The CS indicates the US is there, and we'll talk about stimulus substitution, Pavlov's theory of classical conditioning next class, but seems like the CS takes on some of these properties of the US. So here's a couple of quick little examples. So there's our key light up here. Here's the food dispenser down below. This pigeon's just going through the training here. It's not quite clear what's going on. Well, this works a little better, at least it's sort of perhaps vaguely. It's like, what's that over there? Is that a camera? What's going on? Okay, there we go, eating the food. Time passes. Okay, notice it's attending to the light now. It does go over and get the food, but not as rapidly there. It's really paying attention to the light. Oh, it's tracking the light. It's orienting up towards the light there. It does eat, but it's like, where'd the light go? And I think this is the... starts pecking. Okay? Now, it's never been required to peck. This has never been required. It doesn't get the food if it pecks. So it's not being, shaped by the research. Oh, yeah. You see what's happening there? Let's see, can I run this back? Look at the shape of the... Look at the beak, how it pecks with the beak open. Okay? That's how a pigeon picks up grain. Okay, with the open beak, it grabs it. If the pigeon's being given water, it will peck the key with a closed beak. That's how they suck grain up through their beak. Their beak is kind of like a straw. And here's something a little more like the sign tracking situation called the long box. So there's the stimulus over here. It's pecking. And the food's just been dispensed, but now it's got to run all the way back to get that. And it may not always make it in time. Okay, so here, I mean, it's going away from the food, right? For not doing anything, right? It doesn't have to peck. It's like, there it is again. Off I go. I'm sidetracking this. Hey there. Peck, 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 peck. Oh, geez, I got to get back in time. I gotta get all of it. How much have I missed? Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, again, that even demonstrates this perhaps a little bit better here in terms of the stimulus control that the CS comes to exert over the pigeon. Okay. So we got very strong biological predispositions coming in here. If we take something like a male quail here, and behind this little partition over here, there's a female quail. That the male could mate with, and a stimulus will, or male would like to mate with her. The stimulus over here tells the quail when this little door is going to open. You can at least go over and make some time with the female there. Initially it's happening, but he doesn't have long before this door is going to close down again. It's an 8-foot length here. He ends up staying over here by the light, and by the time he you know, by the time he's done with the directing his sort of like, hello, baby, quail mating responses towards the light, the door is closed, and he's missed access to the female. Timberlake and Grant did something rather interesting. So Food Cup, instead of something like a light, the stimulus that they use to indicate as the CS is actually another rat. And so when the rat is, when this little box with the rat, the movable platform, slides in here, then this participant rat goes, whoa, you're a rat. And this is the CS rat. And they're like, hey, I'm the CS rat. Food's available. You know, sort of thing. And what happens here is after a while, instead of getting over the food, our participant rat runs over to the CS rat and starts directing food-related behavior towards our CS rat, which does not mean that he's trying to eat the CS rat. It's like, ah, rat cannibalism, you taste like chicken. Ha ha ha. No. What he does is species-specific begging behavior. So he'll start like grooming the CS rat's face, cleaning around the face, licking the muzzle. If in more normal situations, if one rat has got food and another rat doesn't, and the second rat wants to get some food, it will come over and do some grooming behavior. You know, it'll suck up a bit. It's like, oh, you've got such beautiful whiskers. Is that food? Yeah, your ears are like little tiny coral shells. Yes, yes. Are you sure? You're not going to eat all of that, are you? Please share with me. Okay. So it doesn't try to eat the other rat. But again, stimulus substitution here is like, this is the rat that's got the food. Okay. I'm going to actually jump down here. I want us to do something else here. We'll come back to taste aversion next class. But right now, I want to just do something here quickly about eye blink, because then we're going to do some science. So eye blink, another standard classical conditioning component here. Standard way of doing this, your air puff is the US, the blink is a UR. You've got usually a noise, maybe a light or a vibration that can serve as a CS, and your CR is a blink. Very straightforward, okay? This is sort of the epitome of straightforward classical conditioning. After doing a bunch of CS-US pairings, now you present the CS by itself, you get a blink. Lovely. Nothing terribly complicated about that. In part because this is so incredibly consistent, iBlink has become a vehicle for understanding or learning about the neurobiology of learning and behavior. So after about 35 years of research, a guy called Thompson and his various graduate students and other colleagues have produced a brain circuit map for the iBlink conditioning. So what's interesting is the UR and the CR are actually produced through entirely different neural pathways. Now, the UR caused by a puff of air is very sharp, very fast, very sudden. The blink happens quickly. It's forceful and it's quick. The CR, the blink produced by the CS, is slower, there's more of a latency, and it's not as forceful. It's, I guess you'd say, of a lower magnitude of response. Now, if we look at this here, so puff of air to the eye goes through the trigeminal nucleus, and then there's a branch that goes to reticular formation. But either way, this very quickly goes to the cranial motor nuclei. So there's your reflex path. Boom, right there, zappo, eye blink. Okay? You also get the US sending stimuli up into the cerebral cortexes as well. Now, after we've done the CS-US pairing, if we present the tone, the CS, this takes a very different pathway into the cortex as well. But here, the interpostus nucleus, then red nuclear, cranial motor nuclei, and that way. A much longer path. This is why it's slower to occur. So we have an entirely different neural pathway. So the nature of the CR is very similar to the UR. It is, in fact, a blink, but it's not using the same reflex arc architecture. Okay? So it's going through a different set of neural connections there. So again, this is your textbook goes into this in some more detail there. It's the box 3-2, I think, you know, hunting the Ingram or something like that. So take a peek at that. But here's what I want to do with us for the rest of today's time. I want to get you guys to do some science using some paper, a pencil, and a turkey baster. Okay. Who says you need a $100,000 grant to do good research? All right. So, yes, we really can do science to it here. So, what I'm going to do is get you into groups of like three or four. So, allocate yourself into groups. I don't really care how. And once we do that, I've got enough stuff to do eight groups. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Yeah. Get yourself into a few groups. Sure, just move around until you find a group. You know, we'll do this. Hey, science is fun. You know what? Kids used to love to get a chance to do actual projects in classes. Try to recapture your youthful excitement about empiricism. All right. So, we need to have probably at least groups of at least three people in a group or four people in a group. Okay, so. Are you guys forming a group? Okay, so here's your drone, there's your instructions, here's your turkey baster. Participation is entirely voluntary. If you do decide to participate, you can withdraw at any time. That is ceased participation. The exercise is conducted purely for pedagogical purposes. Data from this exercise will be compiled, and we'll do a descriptive analysis next class. So turn this stuff in at the end, and I'll, you know, put a graph together for us for next class there. But no data from this exercise will be presented outside of the class, utilized in other studies, or submitted in whole or in part for publication, because I'm not going to be able to get this published in any way, shape, or form. So let's not even worry about that. No personal data is being collected. Thus, participant anonymity is maintained. And once I'm all done with this, I'm just going to shred the sheets. So you don't have to worry about anything like that. Okay. So one person in your group, decide amongst yourselves. You can, like, play with the turkey baster a little bit and see who's got a good response there. Somebody's the subject. One of you is going to be the subject. Or you can rock, paper, scissors to find out who wins or who loses, your choice. And they're going to get air puffed, okay? One person is going to be delivering the air puff. A third person is going to be making some sort of a tap on the desk with knuckles or the pencil or something. And then if you've got a fourth person in your group, and what do you know? We've actually got a nice even number here for this. They can do the recording. Now, I guess it's possible to, like, puff and tap at the same time, but I think you'll probably run the risk of, like, you know, shooting this into somebody's eye. So I think you probably need to, you know, have one hand to stabilize the air puff delivery system and the second hand to squeeze it. Okay, so the person who's producing the noise, the CS and the air puffer, need to sort of be in coordination. So the person that does the CS, you decide when you are going to make your tap, and then the person that does the puff, try to deliver that puff within like a second. of getting the tap, okay? So do that. You know, if possible, you know, the person that's doing the CS, try to, you know, their eyes are already closed. Wait for them to open their, try to, it's not when their eyes are already closed. If the person who is the subject has glasses, obviously you need to take them off, all right? So please remove your defensive eyewear to do this. And, you know, in your group, you know, practice a little bit. I mean, you know, you don't want to stick this straight in someone's eye. It's like, oh, I'm looking straight down the turkey baster. That's actually kind of interesting. I should have written something on the inside of the bulbs, you know, hi, or, you know, turkey basters in the mirror may appear larger than they are in real life. So practice, you know, how close do you need to be to get a, you know, a puff there, you know, how far away can you be? And try to keep this fairly consistent, right? So while you're doing this, try to stay about the same distance there. Let's see. Right. Try to have ITIs of about 10, 15 seconds. Okay, so, you know, noise, poof, maybe wait 10 seconds or so. If you don't have a watch, that's fine. Just kind of guesstimate 10 second-ish, you know, 10, 15 seconds there. Do that. And off we go. So to record the data here, we've got the test trials down there. So we'll do some test trialing. So point one, block one training trials, do 20 deliveries of the CS in the U.S. Then block one test trials, do 4 test trials, just the CS. Block two training trials, another 20 CS U.S. Block two test trials. With 4 CS alone. Again, in the CS alone, in the test trials, again, ITIs of about, you know, 10, 15 seconds there. Let's do those 4. And then finally, a third block of 20 training trials. And then the last thing we're going to do is the block 3 test trials. Actually, going to do 20 here because we want to see if we're going to get any extinction coming along here. Okay, so we'll do this a bit longer, a few more trials. Okay? If there's a blink, just put a little Y in the appropriate box. If there's no blink, you know, a no. So whoever's doing the data recording is going to have a good line of sight at the eye there and be able to record. Okay, you don't have to be in here. You can go sit outside if you want. There's space around the other side of the food court that's kind of quiet, or you can do this here as well. It's up to you, okay? So let you go with that. When you're done, just you know, bring the stuff back, return the data sheets, and you know, my scientific research tools. Okay, off you go. This really is classical conditioning. We're really doing a classical conditioning study here. So.